Hello, I'm Don Mills. This is number 0413, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0413. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet comic book writer Mark Miller, who talks about his new release, Grave Trancers. Where did the idea for this story come from?
Heard about it on the news, about a cemetery that was reselling plots, and they had a body pit behind their cemetery. It was a really gruesome tale, and it was a real-life tale here in Chicago. Now, like, the ghoulish part of smoking the corpses to kind of get some type of high, that came much, much later. But the setting itself, and just kind of the whole crime family living in this cemetery and doing all of these kind of, like, ghoulish grave-robbing sort of things, I've always been kind of interested in that.
Jim Allen, owner and operator of Allen R. Shuffleboard Company, talks about the resurgence of the game.
The last 10 or 15 years, it's grown exponentially on a global scale. Up until 2005, for instance, there was no shuffleboard in Europe. A couple of Dieter and Bert Husman from Germany came over, fell in love with the game, and started an association in 2006 in Germany, and through some efforts of the International Shuffleboard Association, there's now a successful clubs in the UK, in Norway, Austria, Brazil, Australia, Japan, clubs in all of those countries.
Gary Sweeney is a fan of classic films, and he has a website called Midnight Palace. Where did the name for the site come from?
The palace part is kind of a nod to the early movie palaces that used to be before we had, you know, these multiplexes and everything. And the midnight part is because midnight is the one moment that joins yesterday and today. So right at that kind of division line is where yesterday and today meet. And so it's kind of a almost like a little bit of a play on words. I'm trying to capture the feeling of bridging that divide between the two time periods.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0413 was Don Mills, a retired horticulturist. His former flower shop also housed a garden center and the largest greenhouse range in all of Eastern Ontario. I first met Don during the 2 years I spent working in Brockville, Ontario. I would tell you more about the 2 years I spent working in Brockville, but the statute of limitations haven't run out yet. Thank you very much, Don, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? An Olympia, Washington man who authorities say mailed one of his fingers to the IRS is now facing federal charges. 68-year-old Normand Larivière was charged with mailing a threat to injure after IRS workers in Ogden, Utah discovered a package containing a fake bomb on July the 6th. Charging papers say he also sent his finger, a bullet, and a marijuana joint to tax collectors in 2016. The finger was allegedly cut off with a homemade device, which Larivière later showed to authorities. Court documents say Larivière had been upset with the IRS since he was laid off in the 1990s from his job as a civilian defense contractor. He began filing grievances with federal agencies related to the Department of Defense, saying he shouldn't have to pay taxes because the government hadn't satisfied his claims. Charging papers say Larivière told investigators he made and sent the fake bomb. He remains in jail. You know, that story doesn't mention exactly which finger he sent them, but I am willing to bet that many people over the years have wanted to give the IRS the finger. They just didn't do it literally. Although, it has been known that dealing with the tax authorities can cost you an arm and a leg, so maybe he's getting off lightly. The ad in the airport was outrageous, obviously. Your precious cargo, not cattle, it said, trumpeting passenger terminal upgrades at Billy Bishop City Airport in Toronto. Objections were raised and the poster was taken down. Were the protests about calling air passengers cargo? Apparently not. Critics were rallied by Len Goldberg, who claimed the slogan was insulting to actual cows. To our knowledge, no cows have complained, by the way. So, without naming any names, how does this guy feel about some of the airlines that actually do treat their customers like cattle? I said I wasn't naming any names. And speaking of cattle, the Innovation Center for U.S. Dairy reported in June that as many as 16.4 million Americans believe that chocolate milk comes from brown cows. In fact, the center's most frequently asked question on its website is, does chocolate milk come from brown cows? The answer is no, and I feel quite sad that there is a need for me to have to actually state that answer. Almost half of respondents to the center's survey weren't sure where chocolate milk comes from at all. These are people who procreate, drive cars, and vote. Think about that. Think long and hard about that. A Spencer store in Park Plaza Mall in Little Rock, Arkansas, took on a Jerry Springer vibe on June 21st when a disgruntled customer tried to steal a stripper pole. A Spencer's employee chased the woman into the mall and, in the ensuing struggle, was bitten by the customer, who then relinquished the stripper pole and ran away. At press time, the biter is still at large. Now, in the interest of research, I just checked out what the Spencer store had to offer because, admittedly, I know nothing about purchasing a stripper pole. Who knew there was such a variety? You've got your basic spinning LED light-up stripper pole for $169.99. It only gets 2.5 stars out of 5, by the way. Your chrome stripper pole is a 5-star model at $129.99. Your pink stripper pole kit is unrated and sells for $109.99. And the fantasy stripper pole, Fetish Fantasy, is a 4-star model that will set you back $139.99. All of these prices, by the way, are in U.S. dollars. And that pretty much ends my community service here. You're welcome. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the Florida Highway Patrol arrested the driver of a red Corvette after a couple said he pointed a pistol at them in a road rage incident on the Florida Turnpike. 35-year-old William Ryan Adams in Marin County from Fletcher, North Carolina, allegedly admitted that he had a pistol under his seat, but told troopers he never got it out. The Glock pistol was taken as evidence, and Adams was charged with 2 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. That may cause problems at his job back home. He's a priest at Calvary Episcopal Church in Fletcher. So, pulling a gun and lying to the cops. I think this guy has to reread his company's operating manual. After all, it's a really good book. A really good book. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Miller is one of the masterminds behind such comic book projects as Pirouette, Occupy Comics, and Jungle Book. He has a new comic book coming out in September called Grave Trancers. It's a 4-issue miniseries from Black Mask Studios. And Mark joins us on the line via Skype from Chicago. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. You do these horror-filled comic books, and I'm wondering if there's a chicken and an egg kind of thing here, which comes first? Do you create this all in your mind and someone draws the pictures to it, or do you get an idea from some pictures and then write to that?
Well, it just depends on where the kind of like the nugget comes from. And this particular one, Grave Trancers, comes from a real life story that I just kind of heard about it on the news about a cemetery that was reselling plots, and they had a body pit behind their cemetery. And so it was a really gruesome tale, and it was a real life tale here in Chicago. And the cemetery has since been kind of like reformed and everything, but people still remember that sort of story here in Chicago. And I just thought that was such a cool setting for a story, and that's where it first came from. Now, like the whole, the ghoulish part of smoking the corpses to kind of get some type of high, that's kind of, that came much, much later. But the setting itself and just kind of like the whole crime, a crime family living in this cemetery and doing all of these kind of like ghoulish grave robbing sort of things. I've always been kind of interested in that that kind of subject, and not to the point of I would ever do any grave robbing, but I've seen like some movies about it and everything. But it's just it was just a kind of a fascinating subject and how ghoulish it was, and I just thought it was just the perfect story to kind of like tell a kind of a nasty little horror story about.
Do you find that, generally speaking, a lot of the great stuff out there in the horror or fright genre comes literally from truth?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, you've got to have something about it. Like even like with Jaws, I mean, there's this primal fear of sharks that we all have, and I sit there and I still don't go into the water just because of Jaws. I'm deathly afraid of it. Even in like in out here at the lake here, or sometimes in a swimming pool, you just get this irrational kind of fear that something's down there and it's gonna come up there and just start eating you from the feet first. Things like The Exorcist, I think that really goes into our kind of like Catholic fears and things like that. I think being a little Catholic boy growing up, I was all of that stuff scared the hell out of me when I saw it. And a lot of it has to do with it's a child having like all this stuff happening to her, but at the same time it's that iconography that is used in The Exorcist that I think that really, really hits people. So I do think that there's a nugget of truth in everything, every type of fear, at least at some base level.
You're lucky to be working in a time as a comic book writer when comic books are, or as some people like to refer to them as, graphic novels, where comic books are something that is not poo-pooed by the general population as being something just for kids. Although I'm sure you might find some people out there who might still think that.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And this one definitely isn't for kids. It's got some kind of more horrific kind of subject matter. But in the past, I've written stuff for kids, and I the Jungle Book that I write is very much, I mean, it's got some adult themes, but it's definitely for a younger kind of audience. And even Pirouette had a kind of like an innocence to it that I don't think that that this one definitely doesn't have that. I mean, it has a human element. The story itself is about a brother and sister, and they are going to find their father's grave. And it really kind of deals with that human element and the difference between what the brother and sister, their sort of goals and motivations behind doing that is. I always focused on just the difference between what people say and what people do. So there's a lot of that, and that's kind of what I like about comics. It's just that you can kind of picture it, but you can have the character saying one thing, but then you can picture them doing something completely different. And that to me is just very, very interesting in a writing sense. It really makes things a little bit more fleshed out, because that seems much more realistic to me, that a character will say and do two things that are very vastly different.
You just use the term fleshed out in a story about grave robbers, but I'll let that one slide. I was going to ask, do you, besides following that news story, which I think I saw something on 60 Minutes on that same story you were referring to many years ago. Besides that story being in the news, did you have to do any kind of research to write this story?
I did do a lot of research just on seeing if that was an actual thing. Like, have people ever used humans as some sort of drug? And in the past, it has been used. There have been some pretty famous people that have tried to do that or had something like that going on. There's Tupac's crew actually smoked his ashes. Keith Richards did the same thing with his father's ashes, just to kind of see what happens. And so there are like people throughout history that have tried it. Joan of Arc actually used to do it, and it used to be seen as sort of like a way to kind of like empower the person or to have power over that person, whoever it is that you're smoking. So there's like there's a nugget of truth in there. I kind of take it to a little bit more of a just a little bit more of a supernatural sort of level, not to the point where it's ghostly or anything, but just that it's a little bit more transcendental, and just make it a little bit more tangible so that I can make a story about it. I had to kind of establish sort of rules for the story and just what the effect is. So that in itself took a little bit of artistic license there. But still, there are a lot of little instances. And at the beginning of every issue, I kind of talk about each of these instances and use them. And it all kind of fits in a fun way at the very end of the story. So each issue has like one or two instances in history where this has actually happened. This drug has actually been used.
Yeah, but you also mentioned Keith Richards. I mean, just look at him. What wouldn't he do?
That's true. You know, that's probably the most mild thing Keith has ever done. But
now I understand you're going to Comic-Con.
Yes.
And you have a panel there talking about reinventing horror in comics and film. Have you done these kind of things before? And what are the fans like? Because there's a fine line between those who are really fans of whatever you might do and some who are, say, fanatical about what you might do.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that it's really weird. In horror, you would think that it would be a bunch of scary people, but for the most part, the people who write horror, the people who are fans of horror, it's always such a great positive vibe. And unfortunately, that vibe has kind of changed in comics just for the last couple of years, and it's turned into I'm sure you're well aware of how kind of crazy Twitter often is, and just a lot of people who are just reactionary and a lot of people who are just kind of looking, trolling for like some type of argument. And I don't see that a lot at horror conventions. And so it's weird because we get a really nice vibe as far as who is going to be on the panel, and they're always a lot of fun. Mixing with the fans who are genuine fans of horror comics, horror movies, and all kinds of things like that. So it really, that's been the main thing that's kind of surprised me about these panels that I've had. And I've had them for about 10 years at the last couple of, the last 10 San Diego Comic-Cons. So it's kind of gotten to the point where I would be surprised if I don't have it one year. You know, it's been we've had a lot of great people on, and this one is our 10th, kind of like our 10th one. It's bigger than ever before. We're partnering with Lionsgate. We have the directors of Jigsaw, which is the latest of the Saw movies, and they've also done movies like Predestination and Daywalkers and Undead, the Spirig brothers. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them.
A little bit, yes.
Yeah, and also Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson, who did Spring, and they're doing a new movie called The Endless. They're going to be on the panel. Roxanne Benjamin, who directed parts of XX, which was the all-female horror anthology, and she also did Southbound. Who else is on there? Let's see. We have Brian Michael Edwards, who he is a Top Cow editor, and he also does the comic book Postal. And he's got a couple of new horror projects that are going to be coming up. And Matt Pozzolo, who is a part of Black Mask Studios, he's one of the publishers there. And he has his own comics that he's done for ages. He has a new comic coming out called A Cal Exit, which is about California seceding from the United States. So it's less, that's more political than it is horror, but
depends on who you talk to on that. It can be political, it can be horror. Well, it sounds like you're very, very busy and a lot of things are happening for you. Again, your comic book, Grave Trancers, is coming out in September. You'll also be at Comic-Con, you mentioned, Friday, July the 21st. And people can find out more information by going to your website, which I believe is mlmillerwrites.com, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Mark, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity, and go out there and buy tons of Grave Trancers. It's if you like horror, it's going to definitely be worth the experience.
Comic book writer Mark Miller. His new comic book coming out in September is called Grave Trancers. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0413, and you'll find links to Mark's site, plus a link to where you can order his new comic book. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, the best thing since sliced bread. No loafing here.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about playing shuffleboard. Plus, we'll meet the website owner of Midnight Palace, which has everything you need to know about some of the great classic films of all time. Great information on that site. We'll talk about that a little later on. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, and lots more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, a stash of cocaine hidden inside a Cookie Monster doll has landed a Florida man in jail on a drug charge. The Monroe County Sheriff's Office said that 39-year-old Camus McNair was arrested after a traffic stop in the Florida Keys involving a car with heavily tinted windows and an obscured license plate. A deputy smelled marijuana odor after pulling over McNair's car, then searched a backpack in the car and found the Cookie Monster doll. The deputy noticed the doll seemed heavier than it should and a slit had been cut into it. Authorities say about 11 ounces, or 312 grams, of cocaine was found inside the doll. By the way, you ever notice, at least here in Canada, we have the metric system, but in other countries that don't, anybody who knows grams and as opposed to ounces usually is a drug dealer. Just saying. McNair was jailed with bail set at $7,000. There is so much Muppet crime in the world these days. You know, pretty soon Sesame Street will be sporting gang colors. It's just a matter of time. And sometimes the early bird doesn't get the worm. Police in Iowa are looking for a would-be bank robber who showed up at two West Des Moines branches before they opened on Wednesday. A security recording shows a man wearing a bandana over his face trying to enter the Marine Credit Union branch at around 8:15 a.m. That's nearly 3 hours before it opened. Police Sergeant Tony Giampolo said that employees in the parking lot watched the guy yank on the doors before fleeing upon realizing that they were indeed locked. GM Polo says a similarly dressed man tried to enter a nearby First National Bank branch at around 8:45 a.m., but it wasn't scheduled to open until 9. He says the man fled when he spotted an officer inside who was alerting the staff about the earlier robbery attempt. You know, I've said it time and time again. Whatever job you have, it's always a good idea to do a little homework first. Perhaps in this case he could have, you know, probably walked by the bank and read the operating hours, which is usually posted right on the door. I'm just saying. Not that I'm, you know, advocating crime. I'm just saying. Anyway, the Missouri Parole Board was apparently pretty bored with its job, deciding whether offenders who were up for parole would get out or stay in prison. Parole Board member Don Ruzicka, a former state legislator, admits he came up with a game to make hearings more fun. If a board member or other employee said one of the words of the day, they'd score points. For instance, platypus, hootenanny, or the Johnny Cash song Folsom Prison Blues. Say one, and you get a point. In one hearing, Ruzicka asked an inmate what he had stolen and then replied, "That's a pretty rare item. About as rare as, like, a platypus." Every time someone scored, it led to laughter from the board. A report by the State Department of Corrections Inspector General concluded from listenings to recordings of the hearings that the board members were trying so hard to embed the words or song titles into their questions or statements that they were not focused on the proper questions to ask, nor were they actively listening to the responses from the offenders. Ruzicka has since resigned. Suggested words to work into the IG report? How about malfeasance, indictment, and the Green Day song, American Idiot? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a woman was arrested after throwing a tray of donuts at the assistant manager of a gas station in Springfield, Massachusetts. She resisted arrest and had to be tasered to get her into custody. The 31-year-old was already on release pending trial alleging assault and battery on a corrections officer. In the gas station case, she was charged with 2 counts of threat to commit murder after allegedly telling the officers, "I'm going to kill you, so call your kids and tell them goodbye." She was also charged with assault and battery on a police officer, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, and assault on a court officer. Her name? Miracle Crimes. I kid you not. Miracle Crimes. Okay, the fact that she's not already serving a long-term prison sentence is the biggest miracle of this story. But seriously, when you name a child Miracle, you're already putting way too much faith in the idea that things will turn out well in the end. Really. Anyway. Let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? I saw a recent article online from The Ringer, which was simply titled "The Unlikely Rise of Shuffleboard." It chronicled a bit of the history of the game, visited the St. Petersburg Shuffleboard Club in Florida, which bills itself as the world's largest shuffleboard club, and talked to Jim Allen, the third-generation owner and operator of Allen R. Shuffleboard Company in Seminole, Florida. Jim was listed in the story as the guy who basically knows everything there is about the game, so who better to talk to about it? Jim joins us on the line right now from Florida. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Peter.
Nice to have you on the program with us. So, I understand that shuffleboard, even though some people say it's an old folks game and it's dying out there, the game never really went away, did it?
No, the game never went away, and it has a tremendous resurgence now, especially with the younger people, millennials growing up. So we're excited about that portion of it.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the game.
Oh, I give you a quick one in a nutshell. It started somewhere around the 15th century in England in a game called Shovel Penny. Large discs, large shovels, put them into a scoring area. In the 18th century, it started to grow into a tabletop game over there in the pubs and the bars. The as the ship started coming over to the New World, they were looking for a sport to accommodate the time. And they would play this game on the deck of the boat as they came over. So in 1913, the first concrete court was poured in Daytona Beach, Florida, at the Lenhurst Hotel. And thus we have celebrated our 100th anniversary back in 2013.
Wow. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, I understand the St. Petersburg Shuffleboard Club in Florida bills itself as the world's largest shuffleboard club. Do you know that to be accurate?
That is still very accurate, yes.
How large is it?
The club has 72 courts, which makes it not just the largest as far as the access to the amount of courts to be played, but they have over they just recently passed over 1,000 members, which is quite an accomplishment, because I can tell you as early as 20 years ago they were down to 36 at one point.
Wow. And as for your company, the Allen R. Shuffleboard Company, as I also mentioned in the introduction, third generation owner and operator, so I guess your father and your grandfather were into shuffleboard as well?
My granddad started this company in 1941, and he was one of those guys that had his hands on several things. Of course, back then it was a tiny, tiny sport. You sure couldn't make a living at it. My dad took over in 1967, and he went through some interesting changes. And then I would say I took over in 2002, although I worked part-time for my granddad, just, you know, before going to college, even just, you know, making cues and packing beads and things like that. So it's pretty much all I've known.
You talk about making changes. Generally speaking, how has the game changed, if at all, over the years?
The game itself probably hasn't really changed much over the years. Access to the game has changed drastically. And by that, I mean, back in the 40s and 50s, and even the 60s, every city had one major complex. You know, Lakeland had a big complex. Avon Park had a big complex. Clearwater, St. Pete. And all the players drove to this complex to play. In the 70s, when the mobile home was becoming very big and the condominiums, the mobile home started putting in four courts here, six courts here. So instead of having the big, big, big club with thousands of members, it was more spread out. It's always been, because of the weather conditions, a sport in the Florida, Texas, Arizona, California, where there's good weather, because your concrete would crack up north. The access to the portable courts up north has definitely increased the players playing up north. And then as we've expanded internationally, it has helped tremendously, because you can ship them a portable court, and they don't have to have a concrete court.
Well, I was about to ask about the popularity of the game outside of Florida, and I think you just slightly answered that question, but adding to the concept and the problem of weather, is it not possible to build an indoor court solving the weather problems?
Oh, absolutely, and there are several locations that have indoor facilities. Clearwater has, just about 20 minutes north of where my location is, they have 26 indoor courts and 26 outdoor courts. Keeping in mind, in Florida, it's very expensive to air condition the indoor courts, but up in Canada, for instance, in the wintertime, a lot of the residents are in Florida or in Texas or in Arizona wintering, but in the summertime, they convert the curling rinks using portable courts, and they play inside. In the UK, in the Germany, in Norway, they pretty much all play inside.
How popular has the game become on a global scale over the last little while?
Well, the last 10 or 15 years, it's grown exponentially on a global scale, because up until 2005, for instance, there was no shuffleboard in Europe. And a couple, Dieter and Bert Husman from Germany, came over, fell in love with the game, and started an association in 2006 in Germany. They now have over 200 members in their club, and through some efforts of the International Shuffleboard Association and in ourselves. There's now a successful clubs in the UK. There's a successful club in Norway. We spoke of Germany, and Austria just formed a organization and a club. We'll be going over there for an event next year. And then you have Brazil, Australia, Japan, clubs in all of those countries.
You talk about someone coming over from Europe to the United States and falling in love with the game. You've been in this game yourself, literally, in your family, generations. But try to explain the lure and the love of shuffleboard. What is it that is so enticing about this game for folks?
I think I like to say it's a game of chess with just bigger pieces. It's once people get involved with it, they find out it's not just an athletic sport. As far as I have to have the physical ability to put my disc where I want it, but it's more a game of chess. You set up your board. You're trying to get a hide up there, get a disc behind it. It's so much strategy involved, and it's one of the few sports. And I think ultimately, Peter, this is the ultimate beauty of shuffleboard. It is one of the few sports where a 12-year-old grandson can compete with his 70-year-old grandfather on equal, and neither one has an advantage.
Because it's all, like you say, it's strategy. So, again, it also branches or the age group, also the gender group. I could play with an 80-year-old grandmother if I wanted to.
That's very true. In fact, we'll be having an event in Europe in April, and it'll be a tournament, and it'll be a all-encompassing. If we have 40 people, which we will, compete, then we'll probably have 20 men, 20 ladies, and it would not surprise me if a woman came in first place, a man came in second, a woman came in third, and a man came in fourth.
What's more popular, the singles game or the doubles game?
I think the doubles tends to have a lot of a lot more popularity in this area because it becomes more of, you get four people on a court, it becomes a social game as well as a competitive sport.
Hmm. And I understand there's also a professional league too. How big is that becoming?
The Florida Shuffleboard Association has a pro league, which, as you can imagine, are the best players. It is truly the cream of the crop. And when you say the word pro, I use it a little bit loosely in the fact that the money is not what you and I think of as sports. You know, they win hundreds of dollars, not tens of thousands or millions of dollars. But it's more of a bragging right, and it's definitely a very competitive, top of the line people. And there you have at the end of the year you crown a Masters champion in the men, and you crown a Masters champion of the lady. So there's a lot of bragging rights, absolutely, for that league.
People can find out more information about what your company has to offer, because I understand you supply shuffleboard equipment to places literally all over the world, correct?
That's correct. Shuffleboard, I laugh. I say we're the largest shuffleboard manufacturer. We probably do 95% of the shuffleboard in the world. We have three employees. It's a small company. But we spend promoting the sport, I think, as we do sometimes playing it and making the product.
Well, I hear you're a very good ambassador, and I think you've just proven that today. So I thank you for being on the program with us, Jim.
Pete, I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope anybody out there that has a chance to learn a game of shuffleboard takes us up on it.
Jim Allen, owner and operator of Allen R. Shuffleboard Company in Seminole, Florida. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0413. And you'll find links to Jim's site. You'll also find the link to that story I originally saw online from The Ringer that talks about the popularity of the game. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Quick question. How many calories are in a Big Mac hamburger? One of the changes required by the Affordable Care Act of 2010, known as Obamacare, was that restaurants would have to start posting information in their menus about calories. Yet more than 7 years after that law was enacted, the federal agency responsible for enforcing it still hasn't finalized the rules. If you've seen the calorie information at a restaurant, it's been provided voluntarily or because the city or state required it. Some experts applaud the delay of the federal rules and question whether posting the information is really effective or just another costly regulation. A year-long study in the state of Washington, where calorie labeling is required, found that fast food customers didn't start eating healthier. Let's be fair, new rules might not change our eating habits, but they'll cost restaurants more than $1 billion to implement. With summer carnival season in full swing, I'm just glad my funnel cakes won't come with a calorie label. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about a classic movie website. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. But I've got a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you before we get to our next guest here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, a man who wanted to have sex with a prostitute tried to avoid paying for a hotel room by sneaking into a football stadium. The Louisiana State University Police Department said that they have arrested 36-year-old Lucian Hamilton after being caught outside the Tiger Stadium with his hired prostitute. Security at the football stadium noticed the man and the woman climbing a ladder that leads into the facility. When questioned, Hamilton allegedly admitted to hiring the female prostitute. Instead of paying for a hotel room, Hamilton decided to save money by having sex inside the empty stadium. However, his plan backfired, and he will now have to come up with that extra money to pay for his legal bills. Wow. Getting caught by the cops, breaking into a football stadium to have sex. In more ways than one, this guy isn't going to be scoring for a very long time. And a Texas police officer responded to an unusual plea for help when a Good Samaritan called 911 to report someone slipped a note through the receipt slot of an ATM saying that they were trapped inside. The incident happened at a Bank of America branch in Corpus Christi. Officer Richard Olden arrived at the scene after the repairman had pushed out handwritten notes that read, "Please help. I'm stuck in here, and I don't have my phone. Please call my boss." At first, Olden said he thought someone was playing a prank. Then he heard a faint voice coming from behind the machine and realized someone was actually inside. The repairman, who was not identified, had gone inside the room housing the ATM to fix a broken lock on the door. Unfortunately, the lock got the better of the worker, and he'd left his cell phone in his truck, rendering himself helpless. Now, the man had apparently put several notes through the machine, though previous customers either didn't notice them or thought they were a joke. When police realized what had happened, they kicked open the door to the security room, freeing the man inside. You know, when he got out, I wonder, did they check his pockets for any extra cash? Just asking. Anyway, one more Stuff File news story before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A driver in Zhenjiang, China, took drive-through service to a new level on June 10th when he carefully pulled his tiny automobile through the front doors of a convenience store, requested a package of potato chips and a bottle of yogurt, paid for his purchase, and reversed through the doors with the cashier's guidance. Surveillance video shows the cashier waving and saluting as the car pulls out. He suggested that the driver might have been trying to avoid getting out of the car in the rain. That's a combination of creativity and extreme laziness. Yeah, anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? If you're a fan of classic films, there is a website you might want to check out. It's called Midnight Palace, and it features all things from classic Hollywood. The site is owned by Gary Sweeney, and Gary joins us on the line right now from Virginia. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for taking the time to chat with us. Loving the look of your website and some of the information that's on there. You can spend hours going through all of this stuff. How did this website come to be?
I've had it for 11 years now. I started it back in June of 2006. Really, at the time, I was watching a lot of 1930s films, a lot of pre-codes, and from there I kind of went into the film noir, I guess you might want to call it a subgenre, if you will. I got really, really kind of wrapped up in that time period and in the films that were being made and the directors, and I kind of needed a personal outlet to blog about it almost, but I didn't want a stereotypical blog. At that time, there were a few of those, and I didn't really want to get lost in the shuffle, so I just kind of created my own site.
So for those who obviously can't see it right now as we're talking, describe some of the things people will find on the Midnight Palace, starting with why it's even called the Midnight Palace.
I've had a few people ask me that over the years. The reason it's called the Midnight Palace, the palace part is kind of a nod to the early movie palaces that used to be before we had, you know, these multiplexes and everything. And the midnight part is because midnight is the one moment that joins yesterday and today. So right at that kind of division line is where yesterday and today meet. And so it's kind of a almost like a little bit of a play on words. I'm trying to capture the feeling of bridging that divide between the two time periods. What most people seem to be interested in, at least from the feedback I've received over the last 11 years, is the interviews. And that's because I've spoken to several classic stars and also the family members of classic stars, and some of those people are no longer with us. My audio interviews gives the site visitors an opportunity to hear about some of the Hollywood history that we all love firsthand from the people who experienced it rather than me just writing about it. And in addition to that, there are, you know, the requisite film reviews and book reviews also of classic Hollywood biographies. And then there are kind of general articles about specific people, and also some links to other vintage type sites that people can visit.
May I ask how old you are?
I am 38.
I find that rather young for someone to be interested in these type of films. What was the initial lure for you in checking out these older films of a bygone era?
Well, realistically, when I was in elementary school, I was always really, really interested in history. We used to have a period during the day in school when they would take us all to the library, and, you know, this is like third, fourth, fifth grade around that time. And, you know, my classmates would always grab, you know, books that were for kids our age, and I always grabbed something from the history section. I remember sitting next to one of my classmates, and they were reading, I think, a Dr. Seuss book, and I was reading a book on JFK and PT-109. So I was kind of like an abnormal kid maybe in that respect, but like I said, I always really, really liked history, and as I got older, I learned that the films from, you know, 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s were, you know, I looked at those as kind of moving representations of the things I previously had to read in a book. I was able to see the people from that time in motion. I was able to hear the people from that time in motion. And so that kind of brought life to, you know, my interest in history. And then it kind of evolved into, you know, an interest in just classic film.
You're probably an enigma in when it comes to your particular generation. I am the tail end of the baby boomers. I was born in 1958. And so I think the thing that was great about the baby boomer generation is we're probably, yourself not included, one of the only generations that enjoyed the entertainment and the movies of a generation before. And the reason I say that is we're the first generation. When we came along, television first came along and was in its infancy, and a lot of studios would just dump a lot of their 30s and 40s and early 50s movies onto television in the afternoon. And that was like a babysitter for us. We got to see old movies. In addition to the ones that were made in our generation, we got to appreciate the ones from the generation before. I talk to kids today who don't want to see anything that's 20 years old or 30 years older than they are or 40 years older than they are. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, although I will tell you that there's a, you know, it's, in terms of a demographic, you know, of course there are older people who, you know, remember these films from when they were young or you know, from a generation or two before me who, you know, like yourself, who remember these from their childhood and sitting watching them on TV. But I also see this surge of young people, I think, who have found an appreciation for those films. And the reason I think that is, honestly, is because of the change in technology, the fact that, you know, people have access to virtually everything there is to have access to on the internet. But because of that, I think that, you know, it gives people the opportunity to be famous for no reason. And some people who, you know, want a little bit more substance are kind of tired of, you know, this drive-through method of, you know, going from anonymity to becoming a superstar for no reason. And, you know, the people who do want something more out of their entertainment, and, you know, they kind of turn to old Hollywood, I think. At least that's what I've seen in my experience. And also, when I was a kid, I have an experience similar to what you had, except mine was through a different medium. When I was a kid, Columbia House was really big, and those mail order VHS tapes. And through that, you know, my mom was really, really, really big into I Love Lucy. And so she ordered those tapes from Columbia House, and every month we got a new tape, and every tape would have three episodes on it. And, you know, an hour and a half after we got it, I had already gone through it. So I that was almost my babysitter. You know, I Love Lucy was my babysitter as I was growing up. And, you know, and again, it was odd for a kid my age because, you know, I was a kid in the 80s, and so, you know, people my age were watching The Facts of Life and, you know, things like that, and I was watching something from the 50s. That's just how I was.
What are some of your favorite films and or actors of that genre that you were referring to that you could find on your website, The Midnight Palace, or Midnight Palace, I should say?
Well, you know, because there are, you know, people have access to things like Netflix and everything, a lot of these films you can now see through streaming. Some of them you can't. Some of them a little bit more obscure, but the ones I would say are my favorites that people would have access to. First of all, Sunset Boulevard, I think, is a classic, one of the best films ever made. Double Indemnity, I think, is another really, really good film and a prime example of film noir. I mean, it pretty much has everything. Mildred Pierce, I think, is another really good film with Joan Crawford. And oddly enough, one of my favorite films, I think, is just for nostalgia purposes, is Freaks from 1932. It was one of the ones that I first watched before I built my site, and it's only an hour long, and it was banned in certain, I mean, by today's standards, it's very tame, but back in the 30s, it was, you know, it was a big deal, and it was subsequently banned and thought lost forever until it was found. Another copy was found in the 60s, and then it experienced a resurgence. And
well, speaking of,
you know, since that time,
speaking of lost, when you said the title, we had a bit of a dropout. So what was the film you were saying that was one of your favorites?
Freaks from 1932.
Freaks from 1932. Okay.
It was considered lost because it kind of dropped into obscurity. A lot of people shunned it because it was shocking for that time. By today's standards, it's very tame. But, you know, for that time, it was considered a big deal. And so, you know, people wanted it out of the mainstream, and it did drop out into obscurity. And then again, they thought it was lost, and it was rediscovered in the 1960s, and now it's kind of a cult favorite.
Well, I have an appreciation for anybody who appreciates old films, so your website is amazing. People can check it out. It's called Midnight Palace. What do you do in your day job, Gary?
I'm actually a web designer, and I, in my spare time, aside from web design and website, I do animal rescue.
Cool. Well, again, people should check out the site, Midnight Palace. I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Gary Sweeney, owner of the website Midnight Palace. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0413, and you'll find links to Gary's site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Authorities say a New Hampshire woman arrested for drug possession returned to the police station to demand the drugs be returned to her, and she was rearrested. An officer told 26-year-old Emily Moran of Concord that he wouldn't return her Suboxone, a highly addictive substance that can be used to treat heroin addiction. It was seized as evidence during her arrest stemming from a shoplifting incident. The officer said he saw Moran get into a car and start to drive away. Earlier, police determined that Moran's license and registration were suspended. She was arrested after a struggle. Moran was arraigned on charges of driving after suspension, breach of bail, and resisting arrest, in addition to drug and willful concealment charges. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're driving around with a suspended license, would you wander into a police station to ask to have your drugs returned to you? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0413. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0413. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.